Hello and welcome to Animal Voices on CIUT 89.5 FM. My name is Carl Ozhakovsky, and I'll be taking you through the next hour on today's program. I'm very excited for this, actually. I'm excited every week, and I think I say this every week, but I'm really excited to have this guest on the program. Today I'll be speaking with Peter Laufer, PhD. He has recently written a book called Forbidden Creatures, Inside the World of Animal Smuggling and Exotic Pets. He's also the author of The Dangerous World of Butterflies, which was about butterfly poaching. And it's a topic that we haven't really covered on Animal Voices before, so I'm always excited to break some new ground. We've talked about it, I think, in a sort of more indirect way, but I'm really, really happy to do this show and to have Peter Laufer on the program to talk about his book, Forbidden Creatures. In the meantime, though, I'm going to get to one piece of news that if you live in Toronto, I don't know, maybe this comes as a shock to you and maybe not. This is a story from the Toronto Star, thestar.com. The headline is, Humane Society Charges Dropped. The Crown dropped all charges against former Toronto Humane Society President Tim Tro and other former THS leaders Monday morning in an old City Hall court. Crown Attorney Christine Magui told the court that the search warrant obtained by the Ontario Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Animals for its raid on the THS and the manner in which the OSPCA executed it involved, quote, several serious breaches of the Canadian Charter of Rights, protection against unreasonable search and seizure. Magui said that, given the problem with the warrant and its execution, continued prosecution would have brought, quote, administration of justice into question. She also said the problems meant that there was no reasonable prospect of conviction. The unexpected move came nearly 9 months after OSPCA agents and Toronto police officers raided the THS shelter on River Street, handcuffed Tro and the other four men charged, and led them into police cars in view of reporters and photographers the OSPCA had notified about the raid. Tro, former business manager Romeo Bernardino, former operations manager Gary McCracken, and former shelter supervisor Andy Bechtel were charged with criminal animal cruelty, conspiracy to commit an indictable offense, and obstruction of a peace officer. Former chief veterinarian Stephen Sheridan was charged with animal cruelty and conspiracy to commit an indictable offense. A sixth former THS leader, Vijay Kumar, was charged with animal cruelty months later. In addition, the charity's entire board of directors was charged with non-criminal animal cruelty under the Provincial OSPCA Act. The charges followed a series of spring 2009 newspaper articles that suggested THS animals were suffering because of Tro's reluctance to euthanize them, his alleged micromanagement of veterinary decisions, and an alleged shortage of food, medication, and staff. The article set in motion a chain of events that resulted in the May 2010 election of the current THS Board of Directors, a group of Tro critics, which ran under the name Faces of Change. Outraged animal lovers responded to the articles by demanding an investigation by the OSPCA, a charity empowered by the province to enforce animal cruelty laws. The OSPCA conducted one. To obtain the search warrant for the November 2009 raid, it submitted more than 75 pages of testimony from THS veterinarians, animal care workers, and volunteers. Many of the people quoted in the document said THS animals were indeed suffering. Nonetheless, the raid and the highly visible manner in which it was conducted were criticized by the THS and supporters of its leaders. They alleged the OSPCA was unjustly attempting to destroy a fundraising rival with which it had a long history of conflict. They also said Tro was being attacked merely for holding a conservative stance on euthanasia. The raid was further disputed on legal grounds. Frank Adario, the lawyer for the THS's board, filed a court challenge to the OSPCA's search warrant, which did not include an end date. The investigation that followed the raid was questioned when the OSPCA acknowledged its lead investigator, Kevin Struben, had begun dating a THS employee. An OSPCA spokeswoman told the Toronto Sun that the employee, who was eventually laid off, did not, quote, have anything to do with the investigation, and that the OSPCA did not believe, quote, there was any compromising whatsoever of the situation. The OSPCA became embroiled in a controversy of its own in May when it euthanized 99 animals after an outbreak of ringworm at its York Region shelter in Newmarket. Last week, it announced that former Ontario Veterinary College Dean Alan Meek and former Ontario Superior Court Chief Justice Patrick Lesage would lead a review of its handling of that case. So that is the news, my friends. I'm a little bit of a pregnant silent pause after that story. If you've been listening to Animal Voices for a while, you know that the Toronto Humane Society controversy has been in the news for quite some time, and you know that we've been covering it, and that we even interviewed one of the Faces of Change candidates on the program, which you can check out in our archive at www.animalvoices.ca. So it looks like the saga continues. Or perhaps not. Perhaps the dropping of these charges means that the story is more or less over, but I have a feeling that that's not the case. Something in my gut is telling me that. You're listening to Animal Voices on CIUT 89.5 FM. If you have any questions or comments about this show, please do drop us a line, animalvoices@gmail.com, or you can check out our website with over 300 archived programs at www.animalvoices.ca. On today's program, we're speaking with Peter Laufer. He is the author of Forbidden Creatures, Inside the World of Animal Smuggling and Exotic Pets. And because I'm interviewing Mr. Laufer today, I wanted to play a piece of audio from a few months back. Many of our listeners may not be aware that the trade in exotic animals happens pretty much everywhere, including our home base of Ontario. And this is a recording that was done at the Ontario Livestock Exchange recently when they had their annual exotic animal auction. To give some background context, this auction had quite a bit of controversy surrounding it because of some complaints to City Council. The audio that I'm going to play is a speech made by the man who runs the exotic animal auction, Tim Height, and this is him talking about the controversy. So you're going to get to hear a little bit of, I guess, the other side of what is a debate about the owning and keeping of live exotic animals, and then we'll get to the interview with Peter Laufer. So listen to this, think about it, and we'll be back right afterwards.
Thank everyone for coming. Second thing is, you notice we raised the admission. Everyone needs an armband on. Now, what you maybe do or don't know is we've been having issues with the town council. We have an animal bylaw within this township where we cannot have exotic animals. We were exempted from this bylaw back in 2001. We went to council, we were exempted. 2006, they changed the bylaw. Forgot about it. It wasn't a big problem until last year. They had one complaint. One lady complained, and they said, oh, wait a minute, we have a bylaw against this stuff. You can't have this stuff here. So we went back to them, and they said, okay, make us up a list of animals that you normally had or what you would like to have. That's the list that if you got a flyer, that's what's on the back of your flyer. That's what we made up. We said, we don't have any lions, we don't have any tigers, we don't have wolves, we don't let that stuff in. Snakes that grow over 6 feet, we don't let it in. And this is a list of what we would like to have. Kangaroos, lemurs, monkeys, if you have issues with them, we'll make them have a death certificate. We want the Dakota Mundis, we want the Canids. So we put that in them. And they looked at that and said, okay, let's see what the Humane Society says. Humane Society came back and said, whoa, we can't do that. Those things are way too dangerous. The only thing that we can let you have is ungulates. So town council said, okay, we got to go with them. Ungulates being zebras, camels, all the antelope family, all of our elands, nilgai, all those things. Yeah, we laughed about the same way. So in their bylaw, it even states, we do know that properly caged exotic animals are not dangerous. Well, they just took out all the stuff that's caged. All of our marsupials, all of our lemurs, none of them are out. We told it out that we have a good record that, you know, nobody's ever got hurt. Oh, well, we can't go against the Humane Society. So, up until 2 weeks ago, we weren't going to have a sale. We can't have any of our main items. So then we went back to council and we said, look, how about if we video them? It's not an animal welfare issue. They have no problem with the way we treat the animals. They had a public safety issue. So let's take the public safety out of it then. We will video the animals and sell them via video. I said, okay, let's try that. That sounds like a good idea. So that's what we're doing today. We have ringtail lemurs here. We have black and white lemurs. We have Patagonian cavies, lots of them. We have Coatimundis. We have Patagonian cavies, snow macaques, sugar gliders, hedgehogs, prairie dogs, and all those things. We have a video screen here somewhere. Will be sold at 1 o'clock via video. Now, if you buy them, you do not have to pay for them yet. You buy them here, you come, you get them, you look at them, and you say, oh, yep, that's what I bought. It's got both its ears, all its four legs are good, we're good to go. You give me your check. You now own the animal. If whenever you get to see them, all of a sudden you notice that, hey, it's only got a half an ear. We didn't know that whenever we bought it. Not a problem. I own it. And I'll give you that leeway. Now, we're going to get this changed for another sale. But for this sale, this is the only thing we could do. Now, I'm going to provide you with some paper and some pens. And anyone who has any ideas or anything you'd like to say to council, keep it nice. We're trying to be friendly. If you write them down, we'll make sure they get to council. Now, so far, we got WISPA and PETA and all those other acronyms up against us. And it was actually them who suggested the video. Melissa Matlow from WISPA, in her little speech to council, said they got other ways to sell these things. They can sell them via the internet. Sounds like a plan. So, we're going to go video. So that was actually her idea. Now, so that's the way we're going to do it today. We're hoping to get a change for the next sale. But bear with us for this sale, because this is the way we have to do it.
Jim, way to go for not giving up.
Now, the other thing that we're going to try to do here, I'm just going to be on a soapbox for a little bit longer, is we're going to try and get organized to put a stop to this. This is the tip of the iceberg. If they get this stopped, you know, the sale, it just trickles on down. Then the next thing, we can't have a horse sale. Then you can't have a cow sale. Then you can't, you know, there's nothing. So we're trying to get this stopped. Now, Tony Porter over here is going to try to arrowhead a little bit of an organization to give us a little bit more where everyone can stand behind. I'm a single person. You're a single person. As individuals, we can't lobby the government, and we can't do anything. But if we can come with an organization, PETA is an organization. That's how they can lobby the government. WISPA, all those ones, the FCPA, they started out as an organization. Then they got the power. We don't have quite the money that they have, but we're going to try and get the power. So Tony is going to try to do a little bit of an organization. Do you want to speak, Tony, or do you just want them to talk to you individually?
So that was audio of Tim Height. Tim Height has his own exotic animal company that he runs out of Ontario, and that was some audio taken at the Ontario Livestock Exchange just a few months back at their annual exotic animal auction. You may not have known that this happens in Ontario, but indeed it does. And that brings us to the interview. Today on Animal Voices, we're speaking with Peter Laufer. He's the author of Forbidden Creatures Inside the World of Animal Smuggling and Exotic Pets. He is the author of more than a dozen books that deal with social and political issues, including the widely praised The Dangerous World of Butterflies, Mission Rejected, Wetback Nation, and Iron Curtain Rising. He is the James N. Wallace Chair of Journalism at the University of Oregon School of Journalism and Communication, and you can find out more about his books at peterlaufer.com, or you can listen to the next 45 minutes as we talk about dangerous creatures. It's my great pleasure to welcome Peter Laufer to the program. Peter, thanks so much for being here.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be with you. Good morning. And it's so fun to listen to that audio, and it made me think about the differences that we do have across the border. The auctioneer, or whatever his role was, sounded so graceful and, as we might say down here, so Canadian.
So maybe describe to me the difference about what it might be like down, and by down here you mean in the U.S.
Yeah, and you brought me right back to Macon, Missouri, where I went to the Lally Brothers exotic animal auction as part of the research for the book, and there wasn't that gentle camaraderie that I just heard, and of course that was just an isolated few minutes, and the auction may have been very similar to the one that I experienced, but it sounded much more like any kind of an auction without any explanation to it. The animals were just paraded into the ring, and the auctioneer was doing his very fast talk to drive up the bids.
Hmm. So I wanted to ask you, because you've obviously written about a lot of different issues through your career as a journalist, but recently you've taken up writing about animals, and specifically butterflies, and now a range of, you know, what we here in North America would call exotic animals. So I wanted to ask you, what turned your attention to these issues in the first place?
It was serendipitous, and now I can't seem to get away from it. I'm in the middle of researching a third book that deals with trying to find that point where animal use becomes animal abuse. It all came out of a speech I was giving at a bookstore in Bellingham, Washington, and it was a very hot summer day. There was a television crew there from C-SPAN, so their lights were up. I had a suit on, and I was wired with a microphone, so I couldn't take the suit coat off. There was no air conditioning, and I was talking about my book, Mission Rejected, which deals, it's a Canadian connection, it deals with soldiers who came back from the war in Iraq opposed to it or chose not to deploy to the war, and some of those, as you undoubtedly know, went up to Canada in an attempt to replicate what occurred during the Vietnam War for those who were opposed to that war. And toward the end of that hour, somebody in the audience said, "What is your next book going to be about?" And I have no idea where this came from, but just as an attempt to get off the stage quickly and answer, I said, "This has been all so difficult to deal with this issue of the Iraq War and those opposed to it. My next book is going to be about butterflies and flowers." and much as you just laughed, there was a titter went through the crowd. I was relieved. I said, "Thank you very much," waved and exited stage right. And as a result of the television broadcast, my email address was on the screen. I received a barrage of email messages, and about half of them said that I was a traitor for writing the book, and about half that I was a hero for writing the book. Mm-hmm. And in the middle of all of that was one message from a woman, an American expat living in Nicaragua, who said that she and her husband were running a butterfly reserve in Nicaragua, and that she knew I was making a joke, but in fact, there was a story under the veneer of the butterfly world as it's commonly recognized, and that I should come down and meet with them and they would tell me some stories. And that's how I got into this business that you're in, and realized that right in front of me was all of this amazing material that I should have been paying attention to when I was running around the world chasing wars and pestilence.
And so you wrote the book, The Dangerous World of Butterflies. I remember, and you tell the story at the beginning of the book, Forbidden Creatures, and I remember seeing your interview on Jon Stewart where, you know, he's saying what kind of, you know, he's imagining this scenario where it's kind of like a James Bond supervillain who's poaching butterflies, because it seems like such a strange and eccentric thing to be doing. And in a way, I think probably the trade in exotic animals to some degree seems similar. In your introduction, you pose the question, what kind of people would do this? And so how did you turn your attention from butterflies towards a larger scope of exotic animals? And what kind of people did you encounter in your travels?
What occurred was, when I was researching the dangerous world of butterflies, I realized that obviously that there is going to be trade in that which is forbidden and that which is allowed in other animals in addition to butterflies. And I spent time with a U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service special agent who was on the trail of a self-proclaimed world's most wanted butterfly smuggler. And during my time with the agent, he was sharing stories with me about other cases, and that introduced me to this world that really was quite unknown to me, that people keep as pets, and the word pets is in quotation marks, because mm-hmm. what exactly is a pet is one of the things I started to wonder about, but people keep as what they call pets these animals that most of us don't associate with our dogs and cats, the big cats, the great apes, the long snakes, mm-hmm. some of them perfectly legal, some of them not. And initially I was going to look into the trade, learn how these animals, when they're illegal, get into the United States and cross international borders. But as interesting as that is, and it does certainly play a role in the book, I became much more intrigued with the personalities, as you say. Who wants these? Why do they want them? And there are several types, but they seem, many of them, seem to belong to a group that is seeking attention, wants to exert power, and wants to do something different. I think those are the three common denominators.
I wanted to rewind maybe a little bit and talk history, because you mentioned that the internet has really changed the game in exotic animal trade, and it got me to thinking about what might exotic pet trade or exotic animal trade have looked like before the internet.
Well, if we go way back, the exotic pet trade was dominated, as in many ways it still is with our cultural changes, but dominated by those in power and those with money. And Marco Polo writes of being with the Kublai Khan and watching him have a lion at his side that was docile. The Roman Empire is famous for the emperors importing animals from Africa that were not common in what is now Italy. And into our own era, those who have power in business, William Randolph Hearst, the newspaper mogul here in California, had his own private zoo that became the zoo that today is the San Francisco Municipal Zoo. And then we find, for these same reasons, those who are engaged in nefarious and illegal activity other than what they're doing with their animals, like drug smugglers, enjoy having these menageries because it shows how powerful they are if they can show their underlings that they are exerting control over wild animals that are dangerous, and because it's something that they can spend their money on.
I'd like to talk about how the internet's changed the game, though, because I remember reading a story actually on this very program probably about, oh, I don't know, a year, maybe 2 years ago. It's rarely in the news, but eBay was banning the sale of ivory on their site. And this was extremely shocking to me, and I thought, you can buy ivory on eBay? And I started to look into it a little bit more, and I found it somewhat of a difficult zone to penetrate. But what does the internet do for exotic animal smuggling, and what does that look like? Like, are there chat rooms or forums, or how does this...
Yeah, there's a lot out there, as there is, I guess, about everything. But even while we're talking, you and your listeners could punch up something like tiger for sale, something simple like that, and two initial kinds of responses will likely show up at the top. I haven't done this for a while, but I can't imagine it's changed. One is that those who are opposed to this sort of traffic will have figured out a way to have an easy query like tiger for sale routed to their anti-exotic pets sites. But at the same time, you also will get routed probably still to those who are trying to sell the animals. And then you have to make a decision as the consumer if you're going to engage in something that could well be illegal depending on where you live, if you buy it and then transport it from where it's being sold, because there are places in North America where it's perfectly legal to captive breed tigers and sell them, but there are laws then that would preclude you getting them, for example, if it crossed state lines down here in the United States, the violation of something called the Lacey Act, if it isn't handled in a certain manner with certain types of permits. you suggested, the chat rooms, those who are opposed to this trade and the maintenance of so-called exotic pets, and then those who want to swap stories. And the story swapping chat rooms are really fascinating to look into, because one does get a sense of the personalities involved and the psychology involved in maintaining this kind of a relationship.
You say in the introduction, animal smuggling exists because there's a market for it. I guess that's sort of what I'm getting at with talking about how the internet has contributed to this, because in a lot of ways, it's a market that's hidden from view. I mean, even though the exotic animal auctions are more or less open to the public if you pay a nominal fee to get in, for the most part, these are things that aren't tapped into the public's consciousness. And so what does the animal market look like, I guess, and who are the buyers? You mentioned in your book some of the places that these animals can end up: roadside attractions, circuses, zoos, research laboratories, and even sanctuaries. So how do these different areas or groups of people all sort of fit into this trade?
Yeah, you're right. You have to go looking for this. It's not underground, but it's not in our faces. And there are different types and organizations that are seeking these animals, not always for the best uses in terms of the animal's point of view. I'm not sure if there is a real common denominator. There's a disparate group. One that I keyed in on looking at, because they seemed to be usually unfortunate victims in a way themselves, are those who are confident that they are going to have a different experience, that they are going to figure out how to raise the animal as if they were its mother, and hence the animal would bond with them and love them, and everybody would live happily ever after, having a chimpanzee in the house or a big cat in the house. Almost always these stories end up with a, if not a tragic turn, at least a negative turn. Mm-hmm. There are exceptions, and I devote some time to a couple in Pahrump, Nevada, who really seem to have figured out how to do this properly, if there is a scenario for doing it properly. But in terms of finding some kind of common denominator, you ran through the litany of types, and I think that the attraction of these animals to them are different for each of those.
Mm-hmm. I'd like to talk, I guess, a little bit more about this concept of an exotic pet, and you get more into it later in the book. So we're going to take a very short break to play a station ID, and then we'll be right back if you'd like to stick around. Welcome back to Animal Voices on CIUT 89.5 FM. We're back with Peter Lauford, the author of Forbidden Creatures, Inside the World of Animal Smuggling and Exotic Pets. Peter, I wanted to ask you, how much of the sort of demand for exotic animals is celebrity-driven?
Maybe all of it. It's celebrity-driven as we know known celebrities, and then celebrity-driven by those we might identify as unknown, who want to be known for something, even if it is in their small community, their cadre of friends and family, because there is no question that one of the aspects of having an animal that is other than the usual goldfish, cat, or dog is the attention that it brings to the owner and caretaker of the animal. It's without question an ego-driven activity.
I wanted to discuss the definition of pet, because even in the subtitle of the book, it says Inside the World of Animal Smuggling and Exotic Pets. But you also, of course, discuss the way that these animals are used for circuses, zoos, and, you know, roadside attractions and that sort of thing. But the idea of them being pets or part of the family that, you know, buys them or smuggles them back home seems to be a different sort of drive. It doesn't seem so much about the celebrity thing to me. Would I be correct in saying that?
Yeah, I think you're right. I think about this mother-daughter couple that went to Thailand from Washington State and smuggled a monkey back to Washington. It's really quite a bizarre story. They feigned the pregnancy of the daughter, sedated the monkey, and in this September 11th, 2001 environment of airport security, managed to walk her with the monkey protruding as if it were her in utero baby through customs and passport checks in Bangkok, Seoul, Hong Kong, Los Angeles, and then an internal domestic flight up to Washington. They only got caught because she was parading around Spokane, Washington, the daughter where she lives, and advertising the fact that she managed to smuggle the monkey. But when that case went to trial, and the two of them were found guilty of two felonies each, the case is on appeal currently, when that case went to trial, it was this perpetual talk about how important the monkey was as part of the family, a family pet, how it liked to play with the dog. And this idea of capturing the animal in whatever way it was captured, it was bought in Thailand, but captured and brought back to this country, and then established as a pet, seems quite dictatorial on the part of the smugglers, and at least for a period of time, the owners of the monkey. And it made me think in more broad terms about this idea of pet and what constitutes a pet, and how is it that that relationship is equitable? When is it equitable? And I'm still wrestling with that to some extent, but I think that if you have a dog that, as I mentioned in the book, mine liked to jump in the back of my pickup truck and go to the dump with me, I don't think he would have jumped in, because when I said get in the truck, if he didn't want to go, he was mandated to get in the truck. I didn't beat him into the truck. That seems like a pretty equitable relationship. But when you buy a captive bred chimpanzee and move it to the suburbs of Stamford, Connecticut, and keep it in a cage in your house and teach it to draw pictures that you put up on the refrigerator, I'm not sure you're in pet land there. I think something else is going on that is probably not healthy for the animal, and certainly we proved in Stamford, Connecticut, it wasn't healthy for the community. That's where the chimpanzee attacked the friend of the owner and disfigured her, almost killed her.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned earlier that these stories often do not have happy endings. You know, a chimpanzee is an incredibly dangerous animal. Anybody who works with them knows this. I've been fortunate enough to visit a couple of chimp sanctuaries, and the ones that we see on TV tend to be juveniles, and when they grow up, they're just formidable beasts that can literally tear you limb from limb. And about that point, I'm wondering, what happens afterwards? Are these animals usually euthanized? Like, how are the animals framed after an incident like that happens?
Yeah, the stories are really not good for the most part, and it's not just with the great apes. It includes apes like you and me. When we hit adolescence, something happens, and that happens with most animals, if not all. And so when you're dealing with something, as you say, that it can be ferocious, extraordinarily strong, estimates of chimpanzee strength, for example, are that a chimpanzee that weighs the same as you do is going to be 4 to 7 times stronger than you are in terms of muscle strength. And so there can be the ultimate tragedies of somebody being disfigured or killed, and these incidents occur. Or there could be the tragedies for the animals, where they become out of control and then they live out their lives caged. If they're lucky, they go to a sanctuary. There's a couple that I profile in the book who had two chimpanzees, and they're so cuddly and cute and human-like and et cetera, when they're babies and even when they're toddlers or whatever you want to call them at that age. But once these became adolescents, they became caged. And so the family spends 20-plus years devoted to, the family being the husband and wife, devoted to taking care of these chimpanzees that they feel obligated to, and the chimpanzees live in cages in the house. Doesn't seem as if it's doing anybody any good for the most part. But I must say that although these stories of tragedy, people being attacked, killed, maimed, are headline-making, when you look at them with a statistical reach, there are very few of these kinds of stories, in part because this is an anomalous activity. If you walk up and down the street where you live, you're not going to find a whole lot of people with chimpanzees and tigers.
Mm-hmm. Going back to this definition of pet, it's interesting how quickly, you know, the family member, the cherished family member, or the sort of adopted family member becomes, once again, just an animal as soon as they attack. You know, you have a portion of a 911 call in one of your chapters, and the person who's making the call says, "This chimp killed my friend," and it's no longer like the chimp has a name or it, you know, has a personality that has developed over the years, as I'm sure that the family who was taking care of him noticed, but it has just...
That's a really intriguing subtlety that you bring up that I didn't think about as I was writing the book and going through that 911 transcript. But as you say that, I'm thinking about how even after, before and after, the woman very, and you're talking about that chimpanzee again in Stamford, Connecticut, mm-hmm. the woman pointedly talked about the chimpanzee named Travis as if he were a son, a member of her family. That's the woman that had the pictures up on the refrigerator and mm-hmm. in fact was notorious for drinking wine with the chimpanzee out of stemmed glasses in bed, slept with the chimpanzee. And you're absolutely right. When things went amok, she is talking about that animal, not her son.
Mm-hmm.
It's very intriguing to think about it that way, that there's that under that kind of pressure, we resort to the separation of us and them.
Mm-hmm. When I visited one of the chimp sanctuaries, it was really sad in a way to see how the experience of the animals in their previous life before they got to the sanctuary had such a strong impact on their life afterwards. One of the chimps in particular, his favorite food was spaghetti. You know, spaghetti and meatballs, because when he was younger, he lived with a family, he was a pet, and he sat at the dinner table with them, and they ate spaghetti together. And this was something that the chimp had learned over time and stuck with him even after he had left. I guess it was somewhat sad to me because there seemed to be a sense of nature that was lost, and you bring up this question about wildness and domestication. You pose the question, are wild things forever wild? And I'm wondering if you can give our listeners a bit of insight into what you saw in your research.
Yeah, again, many of these things are partially answered or unanswered or unanswerable, but important questions. How domesticated are we? You and I are engaged in this very proper, low-key, polite conversation, intellectual exercise, and yet there could be circumstances where the two of us would meet where we would be tearing at each other. I would hope not, but we have that mm-hmm. potential in us, of course. And one of the things is I tried to get a handle on what are these differences, domesticated, tamed, feral, wild. I really have come to figure that we all are latently wild. But in the context of exotic pets and the exotic pet trade, there is something very odd that's going on that we haven't, as society, figured out adequately how to deal with, I don't think. And your chimpanzee example is a prime one. A chimpanzee can't be brought into the United States or Canada if it's so-called wild and is claimed out of its natural habitat. But a chimpanzee, under certain circumstances, can be legally bred. And then that's a different entity, according to the law and according to custom, amongst those who have exotic pets. So there's the captive bred versus the wild. The captive bred chimpanzee, as you've been suggesting, if it's going to be relieved of being with someone who's keeping it as a pet and no longer wants it or can control it, is going to go to some sort of sanctuary. It can't be returned to the wild because returned is not an operative word. It never was in the wild.
Mm-hmm.
All indications are that it would succumb to some kind of problem in the wild because it wouldn't know how to take care of itself in that environment.
Mm-hmm.
So what are we creating, especially in a place like the state of Missouri, where it's completely legal to breed the chimpanzees, or the state of Texas, where it's completely legal to breed the tigers, and there are more tigers, by all estimates, in Texas, captive bred, than there are wild tigers in India. These are unresolved issues where we are meddling, and is this any good? It doesn't seem like it.
It seems like, in that sense, though, that the word wild seems more about a place. You know, were they born in the wild? Have they existed in the wild? And we consider them domesticated if they've been born sort of under our control, but that doesn't seem to negate a lot of their quote-unquote wild or instinctual behaviors, which...
Yeah, proved out, for example, a tiger here, I'm in California, at the San Francisco Zoo, that a couple of years ago on Christmas Eve or Christmas Day, I don't remember, notoriously jumped the moat, killed a spectator who, all indications are, the spectator was taunting the tiger in some manner, but this was a tiger that knew what to do, even though it hadn't been raised in China or India by its mother.
I really enjoyed the structure of the book because in the middle of the book, or close to the middle of the book, it seems, it's almost like you take a break, like a philosophy break, and you talk to Mark Rowlands and Peter Singer. And I'm wondering if you can give us some insight into why you did that and why not just stick to sort of straight journalism.
Well, the straight journalism just didn't seem like it was appropriate for this for a few reasons. One was personally involved, as we all are. I've got a cat in the other room right now while we're talking, and I relate to these pets, and I can feel the attraction of a servile kitten that I'm petting at this exotic animal auction that I go to, or the appeal, the anthropomorphizing that I certainly do, and I think everybody must, looking at a chimpanzee dressed in diapers and riding a tricycle. So it seemed necessary for me to attempt to come to some kind of terms, or at least investigate my own feelings as perhaps an example of something near to what readers will feel thinking through this stuff. And that's why the two philosophers were such a treat to talk with, because this is what they are thinking about for their careers, and to get myself in the middle of what felt like a graduate seminar with each of them. It was maybe selfish, but felt a whole lot more intriguing than just giving them a battery of questions.
You know, you talk about it as if it's a little bit of a break as well, but there is a seriousness to it, and you're talking with them and asking them pretty difficult questions. And, you know, Mark Rowlands in many ways is famous or infamous, I guess, depending on how you want to look at it, for living with wolves. And you ask him some really interesting questions about his relationship with his dogs, and I'm wondering if you can give us some insight into what you learned from him in particular.
Well, one thing that's really stuck in my mind, I talked to him about how he is manipulating the dog by training him with giving the dog a treat in return for something that the dog does that he wants it to do. And he said, how do you know that that's what's going on? How do you know that the dog is not manipulating me by doing what it knows that I want it to do in order for me to give him the treat? And that's a showstopper, I think, at least it was for me. And then he carried it on to talk about how we do or do not tell the truth, and how does he know if his wife is telling him the truth when she's responsive to him, or if she's lying to him to manipulate him in order to accomplish what she wants to accomplish. And there are some overlays within our species that come out of trying to get a handle on the interspecies communications that we do have, don't have, or think we have with other animals.
I wanted to go back, I guess, now to the animal auction and how these things sort of get, how these things get positioned. Towards the end of your book, you have a chapter about the python plague, and I'll ask you to describe that a little bit. And the subtitle of the chapter is The Snake Seller's Perspective. And it was those words, The Snake Seller's Perspective, that reminded me, oh yeah, I have this recording from an exotic animal auction. I should play that, because it's pretty instructive to hear them talk. And, you know, I think you heard at the end of the audio that I took from the exotic animal auction, Tim Height, the exotic animal, I don't know what to call him, impresario, I guess, he's the sort of boss of that particular auction, him saying, you know, we need to put a stop to this, talking about the protests. He's very much positioning himself as the underdog, and it's very much like, you know, we don't have the power, they have the power, we need to fight back against this, I guess, repression or something.
Yeah, and that's a common theme, and down here in the States, it is highly politicized. And it is our right as an American to own what we want as individuals, and that includes these animals. They are lesser beings than we are, and the Bible is invoked, and hence we have this right to buy and sell them, to own them, and to tell them what to do, and anybody suggesting otherwise is a socialist interfering with our rights.
You know, it's one thing to have an individual right, and I do understand that argument to some degree, although I would disagree with it in terms of owning exotic animals. But maybe tell the listeners about the python plague, because this is an obvious situation where the trade in exotic pets has had a huge impact, not just on individuals' lives, but on an ecosystem, and how it happened, and what is the snake seller's perspective?
Yeah, and certainly the impact on the ecosystem, at least at this point, seems more consequential than on individuals, although there have been a couple of terrible stories about the pythons. One in particular that I cite in the book, killing a 2-year-old, smothering it, a python that got out of its tank. About 30 years ago, more now, the Burmese python was imported into South Florida and elsewhere in the States and elsewhere around the world as a so-called pet. It's a beautiful, beautiful animal just to look at. And the environmental conditions in its home range in Southeast Asia are very similar to South Florida, so it's very comfortable in South Florida. And initially, these snakes, when they're sold in pet store, are maybe a couple of feet long. If you feed them well, then they get very expensive to feed because they're voracious eaters, and they also get unwieldy, and that can mean 24 feet and 200 pounds and a messy, messy containment vessel because of what they do with that food that they eat, that they don't assimilate. So it can be problematic as a pet. It's another one of these cases where something cute or intriguing when it's young becomes a real pain to maintain when it's an adult. Now, they also breed extremely efficiently. The pythons got out from being pets. They got out into the wilds of Florida. How exactly, it's unclear. There are different theories, but some of the more believable ones are people just decided that it would be fine for the animal to let it go in the Everglades and other underpopulated parts of Florida because they're going to do fine, and they do fine out there, so they were unloaded. There also are theories that Hurricane Andrew was involved, and the devastation that came about with Hurricane Andrew allowed a lot of hatchlings to get out. Whatever the cause, there seems to be no question that they are on the prowl in South Florida, and particularly in Everglades National Park, and the estimates of numbers vary. It's really hard to make any kind of a reasonable count, but thousands, and those that are the most worried say maybe 100,000. They're efficient breeders. The female can carry 50, 60 eggs successfully, and there's not a lot known about their biology because there hasn't been much research done in their home range, and they're trying to catch up, scientists here, but it seems like she only needs one encounter with a male to be productive throughout her life, and that means many series of 50, 60 eggs. So the Burmese python is running rampant in Florida, and that is causing problems to delicate ecosystems. There are endangered and threatened animals that are protected in Florida that these snakes love to eat. They're apex predators. Once they're adults, nobody is going to go after them except maybe a brave or misled alligator, and then it's a 50-50 chance who's going to win. Otherwise, it's going to be the Burmese python that's going to eat whatever is in its path. And when there are animals that are down to a few hundred on the verge of extinction, and a few Burmese python are in the neighborhood, then there may be extinct animals very quickly. That sets the scene for the question that you asked, which is, what's the point of view of the pet store owner? The point of view of the pet store owner often is that the onus is on the buyer to be responsible, and the owner of the pet store may make any number of attempts to make sure that there is an educated buyer who understands the responsibilities, but that there's no fail-safe there. And there are a lot of those snakes in the hands of people that you may not label as the most responsible types. does seem that one of the attractions is to wander around with this big snake around your manly neck and use it as what's called in the vernacular down there a chick magnet.
We're down to about the last 2 minutes, and you have a quote at the end of the book. When we try to pick out anything by itself, we find it hitched to everything else in the universe. So in these last 2 minutes, I was wondering if you could tell our listeners how this book, Forbidden Creatures, is maybe related to your next book that you mentioned at the beginning of the program, and maybe when we can expect to hear more from you and where we can find out more information about your work.
Yeah, thank you so much, and thank you for this opportunity to talk about the book and the work, which obviously intrigues me. I really appreciate your interest. My work can be seen and more about me, and if you'd like to correspond, you're welcome to use the address peterlaufer.com, L-A-U-F-E-R, peterlaufer.com. The next book, which is tentatively titled No Animals Were Harmed During the Writing of This Book, deals with trying to find that point where animal use becomes animal abuse, because there's no question that people abuse animals, and there's no question, I think, that there are appropriate uses for animals. So where is that line? Is bullfighting okay? And if bullfighting is not okay, is cricket fighting, which is again growing in popularity in China, okay? Mm-hmm. Is it okay to eat meat if there are soybeans available? And if it's okay to eat meat, should you be killing that animal yourself or prepared to kill that animal yourself? And how should that killing be done? These are the kinds of issues that I'm wrestling with as I work on this book, which is due out about this time next year.
Peter, thank you so much for being on the program. It's been really, really awesome talking to you, and I have to say, I enjoyed this book immensely. It's something that we haven't really been able to talk much about on the program because, you know, it's often difficult to find people who are well-versed in the range of issues that accompany something, you know, the blanket term of something like exotic animal smuggling. So I was really happy to have found someone who could speak to the range of issues involved, and it's just been a pleasure talking to you, so thank you so much.
Well, I thank you, too. It's just a delight to have this kind of exchange with somebody knowledgeable who cares about the issue, and a hearty good morning to you and your audience.
Thanks so much, and take care. We were just speaking with Peter Laufer. He is the author of Forbidden Creatures Inside the World of Exotic Animal and Exotic Pet Smuggling. You've been listening to Animal Voices on CIUT 89.5 FM. This show will be archived on our website in about a week's time, www.animalvoices.ca. If you have any questions or comments, you know what, even if you have some concerns, drop us a line at animalvoices@gmail.com. And for now, see you later. Coming up next is 2 hours of awesome music.